You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Today, a virtual march took place in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of thousands of constituents from across the country sent a collective message to the U.S. Senate and the White House. Don't invade and occupy Iraq. Let the inspections work. Organizers of this massive campaign asked supporters to call, fax, or email their two senators and the White House. Earlier today, we spoke with Peter Sherman, co-founder of MoveOn.org, and actor Mike Farrell of MASH.
We know of 500,000 registered contacts, constituent contacts, to Capitol Hill and the White House. There are 140,000 people who've registered through our website, MoveOn.org, to call their senators and the White House today. Of them make those three calls, that's 420,000 phone calls. In addition, we know of 80,000 registered faxes that are lined up and ready to go today. That's 500,000 constituent contacts altogether. That 500,000 excludes a huge and unknown number of contacts from organizations like the National Organization for Women, the National Council of Churches, Sierra Club, a whole bunch of giant organizations that are also participating.
Mike Farrell, you're an actor from MASH and a member of the group Artists United to Win Without War, and you signed on with a number of other actors. We spoke yesterday with James Cromwell as he was preparing to phone Los Angeles County residents to remind them to contact their congresspeople today. You were also there making calls. What kind of response did you receive from the people you spoke to?
Well, the thing that was thrilling, Berna, was that so many people had already known about the program, the virtual march, and the either had an intention to sign up or had already signed up. Obviously, there were many we called who were unaware of it and who were interested in knowing about it, and some who simply had no interest or were opposed to our view.
We keep hearing lots of different messages from Hollywood, so to speak. On the one hand, Hollywood is painted as sort of a liberal body where everybody is pretty much against this impending invasion into Iraq. At the same time, though, we've seen where some actors have taken quite a bit of heat for their political views. Susan Sarandon, I understand, was booed recently at a public event. I know that Danny Glover has suffered a lot of a political backlash for his views against the war. What has your personal experience been?
Well, obviously, people either are thrilled by the fact that people who have some public visibility speak out in support of a position that they believe doesn't get enough attention, or people who oppose that view are offended by it. And, you know, it's not unusual. There is this ambiguity in the American psyche about people who are celebrated, if you will. They want to know about their lives. They want to know what cars they drive. They want to know about their love relationships. They want to know they're willing to take advice from them about what products to buy. But sometimes when those same people express their views as citizens and participate in society in the manner that we were all taught to believe is part of our civic duty, people begin to resent it and or be offended by it or be surprised by it. But in my view, just because I was lucky enough to have some success in the business I chose to pursue doesn't mean that I checked in my credentials as a citizen, and it seems to me that I have every right to speak out, as does everyone else.
Peter, what message is MoveOn.org really trying to send with this action, and what type of effect are you anticipating that it will have?
Our main objective with today's action, Verna, is to make sure that every senator understands the depth of public opposition to this potential war in their home state. Our overarching message is that the American public wants to let the inspections work. We've seen that confirmed in a front-page New York Times poll a couple of weeks ago. We're making sure the Senate understands that, and we're making sure that our constituents, our members, the senators' constituents, make their voices heard on that.
Peter Sherman. Mike Farrell?
I think the important thing for you and your listeners to hear, Verna, is that the other side seems to want to put out the message that the war is inevitable and we ought to just sort of give up the fight, that what we have done through the work of MoveOn.org and the Coalition of Win Without War and the thousands, hundreds of thousands of voices of people who are not part of any organization but are expressing their opposition to this totally erroneous position on the part of the Bush administration, cannot and allow themselves to be swayed by the campaign that's being waged out of the White House to persuade them that this action is either right and necessary or good. It is none of those things, and it is antithetical to everything we as Americans have been led to believe our country is about or should be about. We cannot give up this struggle, and I think that we are making extraordinary headway into the not only the mind's eye of the people of the United States and around the world, but also into the mind's eye of those people who are plotting policy for Mr. Bush.
Well, it looks as though mid-March is the date where the administration is actually going to launch the invasion. Has all of this made any difference?
Well, let me just say to that, that when we were first getting started, Peter mentioned August, we had our first meeting in September. Everybody indicated that it was going to happen before Christmas. By December, they were saying it was going to happen in January. In January, they were saying it was going to happen in February. Now in February, we're hearing mid-March. My thought is that they have not done it because it is not clear that they can get away with it. And as long as we continue to make that point, we can continue to forestall and possibly eliminate the possibility of this war.
Actor Mike Farrell of MASH and of Artists United Against the War, and Peter Sherman, co-founder of MoveOn.org. Organizers admit it will be virtually impossible to determine whether the cyber attack on the Senate and White House was successful. 63 anti-war activists calling themselves Human Shields arrived in Baghdad, Iraq, 2 weeks ago after traveling across Europe in a convoy of buses. 37 more joined them last week, and another group of 25 people left Amman, Jordan, yesterday to join the delegation. It seems that Monday morning departures of Human Shields to Baghdad is becoming a ritual in Amman. Raphael Kraft reports.
They come from around the globe to the second-class Saraya Hotel in Amman, making the Jordan capital the obligate transit place for those who want to travel to Baghdad and put their lives in between the bombs and the Iraqi civilian infrastructure. While waiting for their Iraqi visas, which do not take long to obtain, the newly arrived Human Shields get to know each other by sharing their ideas about the action they're about to undertake. Most, like Ruth Russell from Adelaide, Australia, share similar goals.
I'm hoping because we're making a strong stand about people, innocent children and civilians not being killed, that this will put a lot of pressure, if a war does go ahead, on the Americans to make sure they're very, very careful where they actually do target any bombs. And they don't go in places near hospitals, near schools, near residential places, and that they're very, very careful where they do drop their bombs.
While Ruth decided to act as a human shield in reaction to the oakish stance taken by her government, U.S. veteran Antoinette McCormick draws her inspiration from her personal experience, serving aboard a U.S. hospital ship during the first Gulf War.
I was on a hospital ship, the Mercy. I volunteered for it. It took 3 weeks to cross the ocean in this converted oil tanker, and it really was, it was a lot of fun. It wasn't fun for the other side. And I expected us to be caring for the injured. In the end, there were very few casualties on our side in the American forces. However, I was shocked that our ship sailed away without doing any humanitarian aid work. And that's always stuck with me. And I have become a peace activist very recently when I really have had enough.
All of the Human Shields have paid their own way to Iraq. Once there, the governmental association, Friendship, Peace and Solidarity, will provide them with free accommodations. This association, headed by former Iraqi ambassador to Germany and France, Abdelrazek Hashimi, will also monitor the dispatch of Human Shields on the presumably civilian locations they intend to protect. Judith Hampson, a British citizen and the acting spokesperson for the group, said during a press conference that she fully trusted the Iraqi people and the Iraqi regime regarding their dispatch on the field.
This would do Iraq, you know, untold damage to exploit the good-natured intent of ordinary civilians of other countries who are financing their own trips. You've heard what sacrifice they've had to make in order to go, and they're, you know, even down to sacrificing their lives. And I do not think that the Iraqi government, I know the Iraqi people well enough to know that they are very, very decent people indeed, fundamentally, and it's something they wouldn't do.
But Human Shield Fred Boyle, a pastor from New Jersey, has his concerns.
My biggest worry, in all honesty, is that I'm not sure that there's enough control or mechanism, organization to prevent the Human Shield organization from being abused by the Iraqi government. I'm concerned at the placement of the shields in Iraq. I mean, I don't question the motivation of the Human Shields. I know that their motivation is correct. My concern is that if the Iraqi government places them in strategic places for their purposes, that the media will discredit the noble and humanitarian intention of the movement.
Nathan Chapman is a 20-year-old British citizen.
It would be very naive if we thought it wasn't a possibility that the Iraqi government would stick us somewhere. I think that is a very real possibility. Personally, I do. I understand that. I'm not being naive about it. We might get put at a weapons site, but I'm willing to take the risk, I guess.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Croft in Amman, Jordan.
Addressing a crowd of 2,500 cheering peace activists in Karis Park in Missoula, Montana, former U.S. Senator for South Dakota George McGovern weighed in against the war on Iraq. Characterizing President-elect Bush as young and naive, McGovern called for reason and sober minds to prevail. The rally was part of the International Weekend for Peace, where millions around the world gathered to say no to this war.
Years ago, speaking of another time and place, the poet said of young men about to join battle, "Theirs is not to reason why, theirs is but to do or die." But we do have the chance to reason why, those of us who hold the fate of these young men in the balance. I think the question is, when we talk about reasoning why, what is this proposed war all about? Is there anyone here who really doubts that we would be here at the brink of war if it were not for the tragic events of 9/11 that killed some 3,000 of our fellow citizens, for which we still grieve? The president and all the rest of us knew who executed that action. It was Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network of radical young men disillusioned by the powers that be striking out against the most powerful and wealthiest nation on earth. So the president said, raising his fist, "I want Osama bin Laden dead or alive." He then unleashed the heaviest bombers in our Air Force to turn the hills and mountains of Afghanistan into a rock pile. But no Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. After a few weeks of infuriating frustration and distress over the failure to capture this architect of the 9/11 tragedy, the president, perhaps desperately seeking a scapegoat, came up with Saddam Hussein, the ruler of Iraq. What a beautiful scapegoat, this obnoxious character. The only problem is that he had nothing to do with the events of 9/11, nor does he have the military and economic power even to think about challenging the military might of the strongest power in all the history of the world. But for months, the administration has saturated the media and the American public with the implication that almost everything evil in the world centers on Saddam Hussein. We have in this country a system of checks and balances that I've always thought was one of the glories of American democracy. But if the Congress and the judicial is not strong enough to check the executive branch, we're in very real trouble. Then we have to resort to what we're doing today. We have to mobilize the resources of the people. The great Thomas Jefferson opened the Declaration of Independence with an appeal to his fellow citizens to show a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. What is that opinion? Recently, former President Carter called our attention to a poll conducted by the European edition of Time magazine, in which several hundred thousand Europeans, all the way from Ireland across to Poland and Czechoslovakia, were asked this question: which nation poses the greatest threat to peace in the year 2003? 84% said the United States of America. I think that's sad, that a country that you and I have believed all of our lives was the greatest country on earth is now regarded as a bully, is now regarded as arrogant and careless about war. I said, and I was the standard bearer of my party, I'm sick and tired of old men dreaming up wars for young men to die in. Half of the crews, the bomber crews that I flew with in World War II, and I might add I'm proud of that service, never came home. Today I still see the image of a bomber loaded with bombs, loaded with high-octane gasoline, loaded with 10 young men, taking off a few minutes after we were laughing together over breakfast before dawn, crashing on takeoff, and their bodies reduced to tiny pieces of flesh. One does not forget those things quickly. So when I hear the brash war cries of our young and, I think, well-meaning president, inexperienced, filled with the sense of power that comes to a commander-in-chief of this country, but I hear those brash words from this man, from the vice president, Dick Cheney, and I know that I'm hearing the words of people who've never been near a battlefield. I also hear the words of Lyndon Johnson, rueful words late in his administration when he told George Bundy at the White House, "It's awfully easy to get into a war. It's sure as hell hard to get out." So I think the old British conservative Edmund Burke probably put it best when he said, "A conscientious man would be cautious how he dealt with blood." So may God bless all of you patriotic Americans who are here standing up for the country, standing up for our founding values. Thanks to all of you who show your faithfulness to what is best in America.
Former Governor George McGovern in Missoula, Montana. Special thanks to David L. Moore for assistance with that segment. Finally tonight, a little food for thought. Author Rose Lord says what you choose to eat can influence our prospects for a more peaceful world. Chew on that.
It started about 12 years ago when my oldest son, who had just graduated from George Washington University, was on a kibbutz in Israel. He went over there in the fall of 1990, and he was there in the months leading up to the Gulf War and during the Gulf War. And while he was there, especially in the months leading up to the war, knowing, you know, that he was in this dangerous situation really made me think about how I felt about war. For the first time, I mean, you know, really on a global level. I realized during that time that I felt that this was not a reasonable way of solving conflicts like this, that it was just how strongly I felt about nonviolent means of solving these kinds of situations. About the same time, my middle son, Rob, gave me John Robbins' book, Diet for New America. And he said, you need to read this, Mom. So I read that book and came to realize the degree of violence that is perpetrated against the animals that are provided for our food.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess being so sensitive at the time, you know, to violence in general, I just felt really appalled by that situation. I didn't know about factory farms until I read John Robbins' book. And I thought, well, you know, here I am contributing to this form of violence every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do that anymore.
Mm.
So I just became a vegetarian overnight, you know, to the surprise of my family. And
you had been a hamburger eating, steak eating.
Everything, roast beef, turkey. I loved it all.
And now you'll have none of that.
None of it. No, not fish, not any kind of animal product. Well, I do still eat some dairy, but that's it.
Well, many people will say, yes, I'm offended by the violence that's taking place against human beings and perhaps even extend that to the violence against animals. But they don't necessarily make that same connection that you made with the food and the correlation between violence to prepare food for our dietary cravings or desires to violence in general in the world.
Yeah, I think there is a profound connection.
Mm-hmm.
The animals that are raised for consumption these days are not treated like sentient beings. They call them factory farms because that's exactly, you know, the attitude that they have towards the animals as though they were objects. So they're pumped full of hormones and antibiotics, and they are made to eat food that is unnatural to them. The cows, for example, the dairy cows in particular, they are kept either pregnant or lactating, producing milk, all of their lives, which are extremely shortened. A cow normally lives for 20 to 25 years, but because of the stress that these animals are put under, now, you know, after like 3 or 4 years, they're totally worn out, and they are just, you know, then they're slaughtered for dog food or ground beef if, you know, if they're not too terribly ruined.
Mm-hmm. You know. So let's sort of move back to the premise of your book, what you learned about food and peace. Is there a connection, in your opinion, between the type of foods that an individual eats and the amount of peace in the world or in that person? Or
both. I think there is. On a personal level, I believe that, first of all, eating a diet that's based on meat and dairy is really not natural to human beings. And so it creates health problems, and it's a little bit hard to be at peace when you're constantly struggling with health problems, for one thing. For another thing, there is definitely evidence that the hormones in the meat, in particular, not just the hormones that are fed to the animals, but the hormones that they excrete in this extremely stressful conditions that they're raised in, those hormones are excreted as a result of fear and stress. And we eat that. And what exactly that does, you know, to us on an emotional, psychological, and a spiritual level, you know, can't really be quantified, but there's, I believe, and I think that there is evidence that there is definitely a connection.
So I would assume the theory is then, or let me just ask you, are you saying that if people around the world change their diets, we could be living in a far more peaceful world?
Well, for one thing, if people were to change from a meat and dairy-based diet to a plant-based diet, the food supply would be extremely increased because it requires a lot more land to raise, to produce, let's say, a pound of meat than it does to produce a pound of vegetable food, of plant food. And so the supply of food that would be available would be greatly increased. You know, people would be better nourished. There would be less reason for people to be at war with one another. So that's one way in which I think it definitely would change the degree of peacefulness in this world.
Well, what do you mean when you say there would be less reason for people to be at war with one another? I mean, you still have the Saddam Husseins and the Hitlers and the George Bushes and et cetera. And people will be upset that I've lumped them all in the same category. But I guess the point that I'm making is people that want to go to war.
Well, we might have less of that because, as I said, the hormones that people eat in their meat do affect their degree of aggressiveness. This has been studied and scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
So we might have fewer aggressive people, and we would also have less hungry people in this world. And hungry people are angry people, frustrated people. So, you know, in that respect, in both of those respects, I think it would affect the degree of peace.
Well, but now based on this theory, all vegetarians are harmonious, peaceful, loving people, and some of them are, but I'm not sure all of them are. And people who prefer meat are prone to violence and discord and hatefulness. Is that what you're saying?
No, I truly do not believe that. I think there are a lot of other factors that come into play in a person's degree of peacefulness. But one of the things that I hope I bring out in the book that is that when you make certain changes in your life, it leads to other changes. I would love to see the White House have yoga classes, for example. I think that would be great. If all the congressmen and senators and cabinet members and the president himself were to practice yoga. I think you just start to take notice of just one thing in your life that, you know, needs changing, and mm-hmm. this leads to other changes. And so I think that there's a whole kind of a peacefulness that revolves around vegetarianism. And no, not all vegetarians are necessarily peaceful people, but the ones that I've met, they all seem to be, you know, in the same kind of mind frame, mm-hmm. you know, and towards peace, towards harmony, towards balance in their lives.
Rose Lord, author of What I've Learned About Food and Peace. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We have production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Benta Berklin, Hakam Takash, Matt Bradley, and Reem Kahuta. Thanks to Pete Karakas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.